The Apostle Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 15:14 that if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. A few verses later, he wrote, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile and you are still in your sins. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is the central truth claim of Christianity. It is, as our guest on this episode puts it, the bedrock of Christianity. So in this conversation with Dr. Justin Bass, we talk about his book, The Bedrock of Christianity, The Unalterable Facts of Jesus' Death and Resurrection. And in this book and in the conversation, we talk about the facts about Jesus' death and resurrection that even skeptical scholars agree on. So listen in as we discuss why the resurrection is the bedrock truth claim of Christianity and how we can effectively present that truth to others. We're joined today by Justin Bass. He has a PhD in New Testament Studies from Dallas Theological Seminary, and he's also the author of The Bedrock of Christianity, The Unalterable Facts of Jesus' Death and Resurrection. So, Professor Bass, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Clay. Really appreciate you having me on.
Now, first, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what your current ministry looks like?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm from the great United States of Texas, so I'm actually from Plano. Grew up, born and raised, and I grew up in a Christian church, but really watered down, not a clear presentation of the gospel, not strong on evangelism or apologetics or anything like that. So I really point back to college. I actually went to Southern Methodist University, SMU, and I was getting a business degree, was planning to go to law school, and a certain number of circumstances, but a key event, actually, I point to, it was Halloween in 2001, actually, and a guy was sharing Christ in front of us, in front of my wife and I. She was my girlfriend at the time, and I point to this moment where we were waiting in line for a Halloween party, sorority fraternity party at SMU that night, and a guy was sharing Christ with the girl in front of us. And he never talked to us, but I point back to this moment as when Christ opened my eyes. This was kind of when Jesus said, follow me. This was the call that I point back to. So it's kind of hilarious because, the guy didn't even talk to me. So, when I tell people, when you share the gospel, make sure and talk really loud. You don't know who you're actually sharing the gospel with. But so I go back to that moment was really pivotal. After that, I started reading the Bible really for the first time, read it in about 6 months, and from then on, didn't want to do anything but study theology, historical Jesus issues, apologetics, and ended up going to seminary after SMU. I did get a business degree, but went to seminary at Dallas Theological Seminary and went straight through with my master's and PhD there. And then, as you mentioned, after I graduated there, I planted a church in Frisco and was the pastor of that church for 6 years. That was an awesome season, and during that time, I was also part-time teaching at Dallas Theological Seminary, Greek there, and also at another Bible college, Dallas Christian College, and I did some debates with some well-known atheists like Bart Ehrman and others, and then just in the last three years ago, felt the Lord call us, my family, to move to the Middle East. So we've been in the Middle East for the last 3 years. Been a professor there of New Testament at this excellent seminary, really the largest Christian seminary in the Middle East, Jordan Evangelical Theological Seminary, JETS for short, and serving refugees there, Iraqi, Syrian, some Yemeni refugees, and just preaching the gospel every chance we get there. So, and then I wrote this book, The Bedrock of Christianity, so that's what brought me back to the U.S., and so that's what I've been doing just recently, just sharing the bedrock of Christianity, the death and resurrection of Jesus, anywhere I can.
Excellent. I appreciate the background that you gave there as far as where you're at and how you got there. Now, you mentioned this book, and this is kind of our main topic of conversation on this episode. It's called The Bedrock of Christianity. So what is it? What do you consider to be the bedrock, that foundational truth claim of the Christian faith?
Yeah, I really think, you know, if you, anyone who studies the Gospels, Acts, you know, the letters, you know, you'll see again and again. I mean, I think that the pivotal event, the central claim and the pivotal event of the Bible, of all history, and especially of the New Testament, is the death and resurrection of Jesus. I think this was the central proclamation of the earliest followers of Jesus. We see this, for example, in Acts in the sermons. We have a number of sermons in Acts, and they talk about different things. We see the apostles adapting their message to whether they're preaching to the philosophers of Athens or Jews in a synagogue or the barbarians in Galatia. It didn't matter who they're preaching to, even if they adapt their message to each one, they always mention the resurrection and climax really on the resurrection. And I would say this is really, you know, not any person's opinion, not my opinion. I mean, I think if you ask any learned Christian across the branches of Christendom, you know, Orthodox, Catholic, any of the Protestant denominations, I think they'd all agree that, with Paul especially, that if Christ is not raised, our faith is in vain. That Christ's resurrection is the central event. It's the pivot on which the cosmos turns, and the center event of all history, not just human history, but of all history. And the only other event that could not necessarily rival it, but at least equal it, will be Jesus's return. So yeah, I would say that the death and resurrection of Jesus is our central claim. It's the bedrock. It's as deep as you can go for what Christianity is and claims.
Absolutely, and that's not to say that other truth claims in Scripture are unimportant or less important or less true by any means. But we're talking about what really ends up being kind of the hinge or the linchpin of all that the gospel entails.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I would just say that all the claims, I believe, in all the cardinal doctrines of Christianity, and they just kind of stand upon that foundation, so that you just keep building on that foundation. Because if Jesus didn't rise, then none of the other things are true. But if Jesus did rise, then I think we have good reason to believe that all the other claims, whether it's the virgin birth or go down the list of the miraculous claims of Christianity, the miracles of the apostles, the inspiration of the scriptures, again and again, I think we see the truth of that hinging upon, as you said, the resurrection.
Absolutely. And as you alluded to there in your response, we do see that time and again from the lips of the apostles and the early Christian writers, that they're constantly pointing back to the resurrection as that key part of what the gospel is and what Jesus accomplished. Apostle Paul being one of the main ones, one of the verses that you quoted earlier, you see him as this key witness to the resurrection. But that's interesting because the Apostle Paul didn't see, with his own eyes at least, the resurrection. So why is he such a great witness, even though he didn't see the empty tomb itself?
Yeah, I call Paul the bedrock eyewitness because what I tried to do in the book is I wanted to just focus on where everyone agrees. So I mentioned I debated the agnostic New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman, and if you look at what Bart Ehrman agrees is historically factual, what he agrees happened, you know, historically with almost certainty. What he agrees, what Jewish scholars agree, what liberal, Catholic, Protestant, go down the list, whatever the faith background or non-faith background, what scholars agree on across the board, that's what I wanted to focus on. And I think on that common ground and on that bedrock evidence, those bedrock facts, I think demonstrate, and if you follow that evidence, you will land at the feet of the risen Christ saying, like Thomas, my Lord and my God. And so I focus on Paul because he's the one that everyone, like I said, Ehrman and all the rest, would agree, not only believe that Jesus appeared to him, so he's according to at least the more skeptical scholars, they would all admit he's our one clear, direct eyewitness of at least an appearance of Jesus, that Jesus appeared to him. But they also agree that Paul wrote his letters, at least seven of them, so, you know, 13 letters are attributed to Paul in the New Testament, but seven are considered undisputed across the board of scholarship. All scholars would agree Paul wrote seven particular letters, seven of those early letters, and then four of them are the ones I really focus on, which is Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and Galatians. I mean, even over the last 250 or so years of critical scholarship across the nations, you know, whether it's in Germany or France or anywhere, they've all agreed that Paul wrote those books and the historical information that he relays are accurate. And Paul knew, not only is he a direct eyewitness of the risen Jesus, but he also knew the earliest followers of Jesus. Again, this is another fact that they all agree on, that Paul spent time with Peter within 3 years of Paul's conversion, that Paul spent time with James, the brother of Jesus. He would have known other people of the 12. He's in Jerusalem, the very place where Jesus rose from the dead. So even though we don't have it written in his letters or anywhere in the New Testament, I mean, I think if there was an empty tomb, Paul probably saw it. Peter might have actually took him on a holy tour of the events that we read about in the Gospels. He might have taken him to the very place he denied Christ. He might have taken him to the empty tomb. He might have taken him to the place where Jesus was crucified. We don't know that for sure, but that's what makes Paul so important, because everyone agrees that he is an eyewitness. Now, I'm convinced by many other arguments that are separate from this book that John wrote John. He is an eyewitness. Peter is behind the Gospel of Mark, so we have the eyewitness testimony of Peter and Mark. We have, you know, 1 Peter, you know, we have many direct eyewitnesses to Jesus in the New Testament. But when it comes to, when you whittle it down, though, to where does everyone agree, you come down to Paul and his earliest letters.
And one of these Pauline passages that you really focus on here in the book is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3-8. Would you be able to read those verses for us and maybe share why this passage is so important?
Sure. Yeah. And really, even a few verses before, Paul introduces it. So Paul, you know, obviously is writing to the Corinthian church that he had founded, that he had planted really about 4 or 5 years before he wrote 1 Corinthians. So he wrote 1 Corinthians somewhere around 53, 54 AD. He planted the church somewhere around 49, 50 AD. We don't have the exact year, but it's within, you know, give or take a year or so. We know it was around that time that he planted the church. And he tells them that what I received, I also passed on to you. And then he quotes what, again, unanimous among scholars, this pre-Pauline creed or creedal tradition or formula. They use different language. But basically, it's just a statement of faith that goes back to the earliest days of Christianity. It goes back to Jerusalem. It goes back to the earliest followers of Jesus. And Paul probably received this information, this creedal statement, as early as could be right after his conversion, which was somewhere around 34 AD, or he received it around the time he met with Peter and James in Jerusalem, which we know from Paul's letter to the Galatians, that was around 37 AD. It was 3 years after his conversion, he tells us directly. So most scholars who really work on the chronology, 37 is a solid, I think, pinpoint to date that. And so when Paul met with Peter, when he met with James, when he met with a lot of the earliest followers, they probably gave him this statement and said, hey, this is what we're using. This is what we're sharing as we go and plant churches. And we're, you know, this is the bedrock of our faith. And we are now, you know, using this with new converts and they are memorizing this. And so this is our statement. And so Paul took that and then he did that with the Corinthian church. And so this is the full creed, the actual creedal statement. He says, for I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, that he appeared to Cephas, or that's Peter, it's just the Aramaic word for Cephas or Cephas, and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, that would be Jesus' brother, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me. So Paul, everyone agrees, Paul's adding that last statement to the creedal tradition. He's putting himself in the line of eyewitnesses, individuals and groups to the risen Jesus, because he's saying, he appeared to me, you know, Jesus, you know, came to me on the Damascus Road. And so that's why this is such an important statement, because of how early it is, but also because it lays out this incredible amount of real evidence of appearances that Jesus gave to the earliest followers. He really did what Luke tells us in Acts, that he gave many convincing proofs that he was alive. I mean, he appeared to them again and again, and he appeared to individuals, he appeared to groups, and he even appeared to an enemy like Paul. Paul was an enemy of Christianity, and yet Christ appeared to him and completely transformed his life. So I call this the bedrock source of Christianity, this 1 Corinthians 15 statement of faith.
If you enjoy the sermons and written works of C.H. Spurgeon, I encourage you to check out the all-new chspurgeon.com. Here you'll find free, unabridged sermon audio delivered with the dynamic of live preaching, articles written by and about the Prince of Preachers, a chronological bibliography of all his books, and much more. This will be a growing library of Spurgeon-related resources to help you in your walk with the Lord. So check it out at chspurgeon.com. So we recognize in this passage that you read for us and kind of expanded on, we recognize it as a creedal statement, much as if someone was talking now and they said, hey, I'll give to you what I was given, and they start to read the Apostles' Creed. We recognize, oh, that's much older than the person I'm talking to is. And so we can kind of do the same thing with this passage in 1 Corinthians.
That's right. And that's what makes this passage so amazing, because it is the actual true Apostles' Creed. I mean, even everyone who quotes the Apostles' Creed every Sunday, if your church does that, you know, I think it's a statement of truth, but it's really just more of a legendary statement, a title to call it the Apostles' Creed. The actual apostles, Peter, James, you know, the earliest followers of Jesus, did not put that creed together that we read, you know, that it was probably put together somewhere around the 4th, 5th century. But what we have in 1 Corinthians 15, all the evidence suggests that the earliest followers of Jesus, which would be the apostles, put that together. And so that's what makes it so amazing. It's the true Apostles' Creed right there in the New Testament.
I like that. We'll have to remember to put an asterisk on the other one. Still true.
Exactly. The other one's just really more of a commentary, more of an expansion on it.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned a few times that the purpose of this book's to present truths about Christ's resurrection that even skeptical scholars agree on. I really like this approach that you've taken, because it's not compromising the truth. It's really meeting people where they're at and challenging them with what they've already admitted is legitimate or accurate or has validity. Could you speak to what are some of those agreed upon truth claims? You've mentioned a little bit about Paul's biography, a little bit about his epistles that he wrote. What else are, what are some of these elements where even skeptical scholars say, yeah, I agree with that?
Yeah, and I really like the way you presented that at the beginning of your question, because I really think, you know, this is, when you look at the early church fathers, when you look at the medieval theologians, Aquinas, when you look at, you know, C.S. Lewis, when you look at, you know, go across the great thinkers and writers and really apologists of Christianity, this is what consistently they've done. They find the common ground with whatever, you know, faith statement or non-faith statement that's being made by another religion or worldview whatever the key belief of their time was. They try to find the common ground that's shared with Christianity, and then they use that as a diving board. They leap from that then to the many other great truth claims, and to really convince them that Christianity is true. And I think we can do that. You know, it's amazing that we can actually do that with the most important, the most central, as we said, claim of Christianity, with the death and resurrection, because we have this agreed upon common ground of bedrock facts. And so, other than Paul's letters, his early letters that have this unanimous agreement, and the 1 Corinthians 15 creedal tradition, and there's other traditions as well, they deal more with Christology. But if you deal with, like, Jesus' claims to be God, and the claims that he was God, you also have these very early traditions within Paul's letters that go back to that first decade that clearly come from these earliest followers that also proclaim him as deity. And so that's also another very important point about the traditions. But there's really four bedrock facts that I focus on. I list quite a few in the book that everyone agrees on. But when it comes to the I would say the proof of the resurrection, what I think leads a person, if you follow the evidence where it leads, that leads them to the truth of the risen Christ, I would say it's one, the crucifixion, two, the claim of the resurrection. This isn't as emphasized as much in other books that I see. I think this needs to be emphasized more, because just the claim that Jesus rose from the dead, which we know that these earliest followers were making the claim that Jesus began what Daniel prophesied, that many who sleep in the dust of the earth, some will rise to everlasting shame and punishment, and some will rise to shine like the stars in the heavens. And so all the Jews really looked forward, not all the Jews, but most of the Jews of the first century and before and a little after, looked forward to this bodily future resurrection at the end of the world of the righteous and the wicked. And so what the Christians were saying was something utterly unique and innovative. They were saying, yes, that's true. There will be this resurrection at the end of the world. But our leader, this man Jesus, who was crucified, he has risen from the dead as the first fruits of that resurrection that's coming in the future that Daniel prophesied. Now, that is an incredible claim. It's Jewish, but it has a, one of the great scholars talked about, being a mutation. This is a true mutation from the view of that's unparalleled in the history of ideas and any of the ideas that were around Jerusalem, that were around the Greco-Roman world, the Jewish world at that time. And so where did that idea come from? You know, where did they get the idea that their leader, I mean, if Jesus stayed dead and stayed rotting in wherever he was buried or thrown away, whatever happened to his body, if he stayed dead, where did they get the idea, this unparalleled, unique idea that he rose from the dead? So that's the second one. The third one is the appearances, the fact that we have multiple individuals and groups, and this mainly is from the 1 Corinthians 15 creed. They were absolutely convinced that this man Jesus, who was crucified, appeared to them alive again and in glory and in power, and that he was Lord of the world. Now, where did they get that idea? And why were they convinced that he was Lord of the world? How did that happen? Not just individuals, but also groups. And then the fourth fact is the most obviously undeniable of them all, because we still can see it today, like we see the sun in the sky. And it's the fact that this indestructible movement, the movement of the Nazarenes, what they might have been called in the very beginning, that they later became, they were called Christians first at Antioch, and then it became known as Christianity by the early second century. This movement has gone on to overtake the world. It's gone on to be the largest movement, the largest religion in the world. And really, since Constantine, it's been the most dominant, the most influential movement the world has ever seen, inspiring untold amounts of really, you know, beauty and art and goodness and joy and peace all over the world. A lot of evil too, but all movements cause evil. But when you look at the Christian movement, it far surpasses all the other movements or religions when it comes to the beauty and the goodness and the truth that is brought into the world. So those are the four bedrock facts that I focus on, and then say, okay, how do you explain how do you explain these four bedrock facts if Jesus stayed dead? If he did not rise from the dead, how do you explain all of these undeniable facts of history?
And with these being, you know, skeptical scholars and just skeptics in general, knowing that the resurrection is so important as a bedrock truth claim of Christianity, the resurrection gets a lot of criticism, a lot of attack, a lot of doubt cast against it. What have you found to be some of the most common arguments against the bodily resurrection of Christ?
Yeah, you know, I was surprised because, you know, if many people who have read, you know, the common, you know, apologetic books that talk about the resurrection, maybe the Case for Christ or some of the others, you know, well-known ones, they're always talking about the really ridiculous statements that have been made over the last 200 years trying to answer the resurrection. But when it comes to sophisticated responses, you know, really and really modern day responses by kind of the best thinkers that are out there, people like Bart Ehrman, people that are the most influential of the unbelievers and that actually have credentials, that actually are scholars. When I found their responses, I really narrowed it down to two. I find them really only saying two things in response to the resurrection if they don't accept it, if they don't just, you know, bow the knee to the risen Christ. One is hallucinations, that basically all these followers of Jesus and groups, they were just hallucinating. They were having some form of hallucination that, you know, Paul imagined it. I mean, Bart Ehrman has this incredibly, I would say, ridiculous statement where he says in his most recent book, The Triumph of Christianity, he's talking about Paul's conversion. He says, it's undeniable Paul believed he saw Jesus. Now, what he actually saw, I don't know. You know, unbelievers say he imagined it, and believers say he really saw Jesus. But I just want to stop him there and say, you know, imagined it? You think Paul imagined Jesus, the man he was wanting to destroy, his movement, the man he thought was accursed of God, a false prophet, a dreamer, would have helped carry the coats to the people who stoned him if he could have. He just suddenly imagined. I mean, that's just, to me, just takes more faith than to believe that Jesus actually rose from the dead. But when it comes, but so hallucinations would be one side of it, that they all had hallucinations. And then the other one is one I actually respect a lot more, which is more this cautious agnostic approach. So it's basically saying, I don't know. So you get some of the top scholars who write about the resurrection, that if they do write about it, they'll come to the end of it and say, it's undeniable this force, something moved the hand of these disciples, something started this movement within Jerusalem, the same place Jesus died, and it has gone on to take over the world. I mean, they'll admit all that, and then they'll say, what caused it? I don't know. So basically, they just pitch it to agnosticism, and I respect that, because really, even in the New Testament, when you look at the stories in the Gospels, the apostles started with really skepticism and puzzlement and agnosticism, because the women who announced to them that Jesus had risen from the dead first, it said that they thought they were crazy. You know, they didn't believe it themselves. So I think we should respect that approach, but just keep pushing them towards the truth and towards the evidence and the fact that Jesus is risen from the dead. But yeah, that's the two main ones that I find.
Now, if we were to, you know, be in a conversation with someone that takes that agnostic approach, or maybe they are explicitly skeptical, but they're open to a conversation, they're willing to hear evidence to the contrary, what evidence for the truth of the resurrection have you found to be most helpful when engaging with someone who doesn't believe it?
Yeah, you know, and everyone's different. I think when it comes to, especially, you know, people of different faiths or people who have no faith, you know, I recommend, you know, for those listening, you know, just always just be listening to them, you know, in love and humility, you know, share the truth, but really, you know, approach everyone in a different way. Some people need, you know, different approaches. So just really, it's a case by case basis. But I would say, when it comes to what's the most powerhouse proof, and if I had let's say, you know, 5 minutes or just a short amount of time with, you know, some of the top, you know, skeptics of the world, whether it be Bart Ehrman or someone like Sam Harris or, you know, Steven Pinker, or whoever top atheist out there that's writing books and influential that's critical of religion, and especially of Christianity, I would want to point them towards the appearances. I'd want to focus on the appearances. And really, that was Paul's evidence. I mean, Paul, when he's listing out that creed, he adds that point about the 500, you know, many of the 500 who saw Jesus are still alive. Some have died, but he said many of them are still alive. I mean, why is he saying that? He's saying, basically, in the early 50s AD, that eyewitness testimony to the risen Jesus is readily available. You can go and talk to these people. You can go investigate this. You can go and interview them. You can go and hear their own testimony. I mean, I saw them. Paul would say, I saw them. So you can start with me, but if you don't believe me, I've got almost 500, and many of them are still alive. You can go talk to them. If you don't believe them, I have a group of followers of Jesus that walked with him for 3 years. They said he appeared to them multiple times. And then I could introduce you to Peter. Peter was his chief disciple. And then I could introduce you to James. James was his own brother. Somehow James became convinced that his own brother is Lord of the world. It's because Jesus died on the cross and then appeared to him in glory. So I think that the evidence for the individuals and the groups of appearances, I think that is the powerhouse proof that we can still bring, even though those, you know, eyewitnesses are obviously dead now, 2,000 years later, they're not alive like they were in the 50s AD, but the evidence that they believe that Jesus appeared to them is just as strong now. And you can also point to the fact that three of them, we do have strong historical evidence that three of them, and those three that are mentioned in the creed, amazingly, Peter, James, and Paul, we know they died for their faith. So a lot of times you'll hear people say all the disciples died for their faith. They might have, but we don't have strong evidence for that. We do have strong historical evidence, and many skeptics will agree that people like Peter, James, and Paul died for their faith, died believing that Jesus rose from the dead. And they were in a place to know. So they believe Jesus appeared to them, and we know they died for it. They sealed their testimony with their own blood. And so So, you know, you have to explain that. So it's a good question for the skeptic to say, what did they see? You know, what did Paul see? What did Peter see that made them spend the next, you know, 35 years of their life proclaiming Jesus is Lord all over the empire and then die an agonizing death confessing he is Lord? What convinced them? What did that? What's that force? And then really even and then moving on to the movement, you know, just pointing to the movement as a whole. What got this movement going? I mean, why did this movement proclaiming a crucified man as Lord of the world and risen from the dead? Why? How did that get started if Jesus stayed dead? I mean, how has it been so powerful in the world? How has it been so influential? Why didn't it just disappear like so many other movements of that time? Or even, you know, people talk about the thousands of gods that have been worshipped in the ancient world. Well, 99% of them are gone. You know, so why is it that Jesus, this crucified man, why is he still worshipped by a third of the world today in the 21st century? How do you explain that? So I you know, where there's a lot of smoke, there was a fire, you know, that kind of argument. If I have a short time with them, I'm probably going to focus on those two aspects of the bedrock facts.
That's helpful. And you can see how those questions that you were, you know, asking to the hypothetical skeptic, how they build off of these bedrock truth claims that skeptics agree on. So you've really taken, you know, as an apologist like Greg Kokel might say, you've shifted that burden of proof over to them is, hey, we agree on these facts. How do you explain it apart from a bodily resurrection?
There's a great, I share this in the book. There's a great, speaking of Sam Harris, if you're not familiar with him, you know, he's the philosopher, well-known new atheist. He has a, you know, very, very well listened to popular podcast. And in one of them, he was interviewing fellow that they were unbelievers, like a scientist. I can't remember exactly who they were, but they were just talking about time travel, and they were asking each other, you know, if you had a DeLorean from, you know, Back to the Future, you know, where would you go? And the girl, the lady that was his guest, I think it was Rebecca Goldstein. She said she would like to go to the time of Jesus and find out what was going on there. You know, what was going on? What happened there? And they were laughing a little bit. And then Sam Harris said, you know, I agree. I really want to go back and talk and be at that time with Jesus, because I want to know why he has such a sway over a significant portion of humanity. And I just love the way he said that, because that captures it. You know, I want to push that back to him. You know, why do you think this man, Jesus, this crucified man, there were thousands, tens of thousands of Jews and other people crucified in the ancient world. So why is it that Jesus, this man who was crucified, why does he have this unique sway over a third of the planet Earth? How is that possible? And then influences largely the rest of the planet still, even if they don't confess him as Lord. And so I just love that. I love that discussion they had about time travel, because that captures what I think I'm saying. I mean, if Jesus did rise from the dead, we would expect people like Sam Harris, 2,000 years later, to still be asking the question, why does he have such sway over the world today, to this day?
Yeah, and that's the real question. And what Paul and many other biblical writers were constantly driving people towards is, how do you explain this? Let me tell you. How can the average Christian be better prepared? In addition to, you know, picking up a copy of your book and reading it, how else can they prepare themselves to defend key doctrines like the resurrection in what I think we can safely describe as an increasingly skeptical world?
Yes, it's a great question. You know, I think a lot of this comes from just, you know, just like anything, it comes from practice. I think, you know, all Christians should be sharing their faith. You know, all Christians should be seeking to share the gospel with those they meet. Of course, you want to build a relationship. You want to, you know, like I said, it's a case-by-case basis of how you share with certain people. You know, really the kind of Sam Harris-like mindset, the kind of skeptical type mindset of like a Sam Harris, I think is rare, especially in day-to-day as we share with people. A lot of times people just need to hear the scriptures. They just need to hear the truth of God's word, and that will be enough to penetrate their hearts, and they'll come to Christ. But if you find someone that's truly, you know, that has reasons, strong reasons against, you know, the resurrection or against Christianity in general, it is really, I think, helpful to be prepared with these bedrock truths of history, these things that cannot be denied, and that you can share them, and then, like I said, you know, then challenge them with that. What did they see? So I would say first, just practice, you know, just as you're sharing your faith, you know, getting to the resurrection, getting to the heart of the Christian story and Christ's death and Christ's resurrection, you're going to be consistently getting more and different kinds of objections. I've been doing this for, you know, I came to Christ about 20 years ago now. So, you know, 20 years of engaging different people all over the world, different faiths, atheists, different kinds of belief systems. And so that's really helped as far as how I now, you know, share the resurrection as best as I can. Of course, I'm a big advocate. You need to be reading. I definitely recommend my book, obviously. I put together a list recently because I'd read so much, you know, just over the last 20 years, but really in the last 5 years, I read so much more on the resurrection in preparation for my book. And I would say, I would highly recommend if you're a big reader, if big books don't turn you away, The Resurrection of the Son of God by N.T. Wright, I would say, is the best book written on the resurrection and on the historicity of it and really demonstrating the evidence for the empty tomb and the appearances. That's his two-point punch, is the empty tomb and the appearances make it almost certain historically that Jesus rose from the dead. He's got a simpler book called The Surprise by Hope, where he makes a lot of the similar arguments. It's a much more book focused on the new heavens and the new earth and new creation, what the results of resurrection, if Jesus rose from the dead, this is what's true about our world and about new creation and the new heavens and new earth. But he still puts a lot of those great arguments in there. Also, Resurrecting Jesus by Dale Allison, that's a really good book, especially on the hallucinations. He really shows how the claims of the resurrected Jesus is unlike any of the hallucinations on record. I mean, it's absolutely unique. Mike Lacona's book, The Resurrection of Jesus, that's another big boy, but it's an excellent book. You want a simpler version of that, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus by Gary Habermas and Mike Lacona. That's a really good, succinct, step-by-step looking at many of the objections. And also The Sun Rises by William Lane Craig. A really short version of his arguments that he's been making. And also Tim Keller's Reason for Faith and Making Sense of God. He really is not giving you any new arguments in those books. He's really working off of really N.T. Wright and William Lane Craig and other things. So he's not giving you any new arguments, but I think Tim Keller is one of the best examples out there in written form and in speaking form of how to challenge a skeptical world and show Christianity to be the good, the true, and the beautiful. He does one of the best jobs, very Pascalian. I love Blaise Pascal, and he said that we need to make good men and women wish Christianity was true and then to prove to them that it is true. And Tim Keller does that just about better than anybody today. So those two books show really kind of the method of that. And then I would just say lastly, you really need to believe it yourself. you don't need to go and preach the resurrection if you don't believe it yourself. So I would say the more, you know, you need to spend with the living Christ just in your personal time in the scriptures and prayer, you know, you need to believe this in the depths of your being. A lot of Christians will say they believe in the resurrection, but I think I through my own work through this and studying it, you know, many more floors went down in my heart on my depth of understanding and belief of the resurrection. And so, you know, if we're not convinced, they're not going to be convinced. And so I think all of us need to have at the heart of our Christian testimony, like Paul said, you know, that we are convinced that one died for all and therefore all died. And so he died and rose again. And we need to proclaim that to the nations. And so that's what I'd share on how to better defend, especially the resurrection. But that doing that will also lead to helping defend many other great truths of our faith, like the inspiration of the scriptures and other things.
A great answer. We'll be sure to link to any of those books and other resources that we've talked about in this episode, and you can find those in the show notes at reasonabletheology.org/episode31. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Could you tell us where people could go to learn a little bit more about you and your work and also pick up a copy of Bedrock Christianity?
Yeah, you can get the book definitely on Amazon. There's a Kindle version as well. I hear it's at Barnes & Noble, too. Haven't been able to go there yet, but I'm excited to go in there and see if it's actually on the shelf there at Barnes & Noble. But I see it's on Barnes & Noble on the publisher's website. As far as me, I don't have a website, but I have a YouTube channel, DR, so Dr. Justin Bass. If you type that in, you can see I finally got all my debates and interviews and sermons and lectures are all together there. So I'm happy about that. And then you can follow me on Twitter or friend me on Facebook. On Twitter, I'm Dr. Justin Bass, Dr. Justin Bass on Twitter. So yeah, love to engage and talk about these things with anyone.
Excellent. Well, our guest on this episode, as we've mentioned, has been Dr. Justin Bass, and he is the author of The Bedrock of Christianity, The Unalterable Facts of Jesus' Death and Resurrection. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the podcast.
Thank you. God bless.
Thanks again for listening. If you enjoy the Reasonable Theology podcast, go to reasonabletheology.org/subscribe and get the weekly email. Each week I send out the latest article or podcast episode, and each email also includes a helpful definition to expand your theological vocabulary, a beautiful painting depicting a scene from scripture or church history, a musical selection to enrich your day, as well as the best book deal I've found that week to add trusted resources to your library. Try it out at reasonabletheology.org/subscribe.